Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
This is a Hat Trick podcast.
Oh, lovely.
Hello, Armand.
Hello, Jimmy.
So here we are again with another juicy snippet from the ancient world. This week it is The Tale of Narcissus.
Wonderful story told by the poet Ovid.
Ovid, okay. Now, we all know that Narcissus is the etymological root of narcissism. And people generally think that if you say someone's a narcissist, it's never a compliment, is it? But
no, but the question is, could it be something that people need to have?
Ah.
Does it have to be entirely negative? And when does it become negative?
Okay. And you've got something exciting news. Join the podcast to tell us about what happened to Ovid as well, haven't you?
Well, Ovid did come a cropper.
Okay, all right.
So we will hear about that as well.
That's the mystery at the centre of our podcast.
Okay.
It's what happened to Ovid. But you're now going to tell us about the sad tale of the boy Narcissus. Over to you, Armand.
The prophet Tiresias predicts that the beautiful Narcissus, young man, will live a long life only if he never knows himself. Oh. What does that mean? As he grows up, this young man leaves a trail of broken hearts. One day, Narcissus is lost in the woods and cries out, "Is anyone here?" And the nymph Echo answers, "Here."
Ancient mythology is dotted with nymphs and dryads and naiads and all the rest of it. What is a nymph?
Well, they were just imagined to be the spirits that inhabited things such as trees and streams.
Mm.
And so they were called water nymphs or tree nymphs, dryads, naiads, as you say. Now, Echo used to be a chatterer, and her voice had covered up Jupiter's affairs with other nymphs. So Juno, Jupiter's wife, had condemned her to be an echo only. So she can't say anything of her own, but she has to echo what someone else says. So this is a metamorphosis. It's a change of the nymph into someone who simply echoes other voices. So Narcissus, in the woods, calls out, "Come to me," and she responds, "Come to me." And then Ovid writes, "No words seemed sweeter to the nymph, and from the woods she hastens in accordance with her words and strives to wind her arms around his neck. He flees from her, and as he leaves, he says, 'Away, I'd rather die than you caress me.' But all that Echo answers is, 'Caress me.' Rejected in love, at this point, Echo prays that Narcissus should be denied his own love, and her prayer is granted. He catches sight of his reflection in a pool and falls in love with himself. He can't drag himself away and pines away until he dies, whereupon he's turned into poolside flowers which bear his name, Narcissi." That goes. Clever stuff. So Ovid is the Oscar Wilde of Roman poets, full of wit, full of clever ideas. And he writes this wonderful book called The Metamorphoses, which is about the change or the transformations of form of individuals like Echo, like Narcissus. So this is one of 250 metamorphoses, roughly, in the book.
But the Narcissus myth, it's obvious why you and I are discussing it, because we're choosing morsels of ancient literature which obviously resonate with us. And narcissism, which we get from this story, is, you know, it's
destructive self-love, yes, is one way of putting it.
Yeah.
The term narcissism is 19th century. It was, you know, something that would have been called egoism before that. And then the myth of Narcissus is used to create this term, and it becomes quite famous in the writing of Freud. We all have a certain amount of narcissism according to, you know, the psychological theory. There's a healthy narcissism.
What's that? What's healthy narcissism?
Well, self-esteem, you could say. You know, it's something that is promoted. Optimism, resolve to build healthy relationships. You could say all those things require a certain narcissistic core.
It's healthy self-love.
I'm
doing things which will promote my mental well-being. So it is a selfish activity. I mean, I always think that being involved with the charity, I always got much more out of the charity than I've given to the charity. We need narcissists, don't we? We do need people who are narcissistic, because very often they can produce great things. They may have terrible personal lives, but I'm thinking about artists. I'm thinking about maybe even some leaders. I mean, they said that Roosevelt was a narcissist, but did quite amazing things for the Americans during the Depression. Churchill, you know, one doesn't want to, you know, speak ill of the great man, but there's an element that he beat Adolf Hitler because, a bit like Adolf Hitler, he was very narcissistic.
Yeah, so I'm a bit suspicious of the idea of calling someone a narcissist as if it's a bad thing. Okay. I mean, you know, as I said, there is such a thing as healthy narcissism. Right. We all have a certain
degree. So we should reclaim the word and say there's unhealthy narcissism and there's healthy narcissism.
Of
course. Because these days you say someone's a narcissist
right.
and it's pejorative, right?
It's pejorative because you're actually talking about extreme narcissism. You're talking about narcissism, narcissist personality disorder, that sort of thing. But I just feel that's not really how the word should be used as an insult.
There was a man called, I think, Havelock Ellis.
Havelock Ellis, yes, yeah. Havelock Ellis, yes.
In 1898. He was the first person to coin the pathological self-absorption and then named it narcissism. And Freud, he actually has a quote saying, as an antidote to narcissism, as we grow, because he obviously posits the case that we're all narcissists when we're babies, we need to be. We live in the world where we are the centre of it, and then we grow out of it, but we retain an element of it, which, as you said, is healthy. And he talks about this, he says, whoever loves becomes humble. Those who love, so to speak, pawned a part of their narcissism. So
right.
he's talking about, I suppose, empathy and loving someone else and seeing someone else's situation is an antidote to narcissism, which, of course, is what unhealthy narcissists can't do.
But in a way, that shows that empathy means that we feel something for someone else. But if we don't have that feeling, then we can't feel it for someone else. So there is, you know, a healthy narcissism.
So what's really touching about the narcissist of the poem is that he keeps looking at himself in the water. And he says, but he clearly wants me. Because every time I reach out to embrace him, he reaches out to me too.
Mm-hmm.
It's so touching, isn't it? That idea that... And he says, and then when we get close, I can't reach him because my hand goes into the water and he disappears in the water.
Ted Hughes wrote a sort of translation of the Metamorphoses. And he writes, your face is full of love as your eyes look into my eyes. I see it and my hope shakes me. I stretch my arms to you, you stretch yours as eagerly to me. You laugh when I laugh. I have watched your tears through my tears. When I tell you, my love, I see your lips seeming to tell me yours, though I cannot hear it. You are me, now I see that. I see through my own reflection, but it is too late. I am in love with myself.
And he's deluded. That it's that delusion, isn't it, of thinking that I can get there. And he doesn't take a step back and think, actually, this is a pool of water.
That's when it becomes unhealthy and self-destructive, and it leads to what modern psychiatrists talk about, narcissistic personality disorder.
Yeah, that's self-obsession. It's not self-love, isn't it? Freud said anybody with a severe toothache becomes a narcissist because all your drives and all your mind, your thoughts are concentrated on the tooth. You don't want to hear about anybody else's problems. It's this problem that you have. And so you become very self-obsessed and self-protective and narcissistic.
But there's something about the modern age that actually promotes narcissism, even amongst ordinary people. So
yes.
When you think about social media...
Well, I was going to ask you that question. Do you think we're living through a period where apparently narcissism is on the rise. I mean, people are now beginning to get into problems with this.
Yeah, I would have thought that the disorder is much more common in a way in the modern world, where everyone has the opportunity to be someone and to be seen and to be central to the world. You know, it's like the joke about how many narcissists does it take to change a light bulb? Only one, but the world has to revolve around them. And that, I think, is the case with so much of the way social media promotes you as an individual.
Yep.
You know, you can be out there, be seen, be admired.
In many ways, you know, narcissist was probably taking the very first selfie, wasn't he? Self-absorption, isn't it?
Yes, and just to take the other side of the picture that Ovid paints, which is this figure of echo. So in the last 5 or 6 years, psychologists have come up with the complementary theory of echoism.
Ah, tell me more. Tell me more.
The idea of echoism is that, and it's, I'm afraid, normally found by psychologists and therapists in women,
right,
is that these are people who actively reject attention,
right,
and make every effort to avoid burdening others. They fear praise, focus on meeting the needs of others to avoid considering their own, and think that going along with what someone else wants will help safeguard their own affection.
Yes.
And you can see how this works.
Oh, yeah.
Very often, echoist types will be with narcissists who demand all the attention, and they'll be saying...
I'm thinking of three couples right now.
Right. And this is a problem, of course, for those people, because they don't have sufficiently healthy narcissism. It's a bit like codependency, except that in this case, echoism is seen as more complex because people with that trait are far from passive. Sometimes they put a lot of effort into encouraging others to open up and share their struggles and so on. They don't want attention to be placed on them.
Yeah.
In a way that causes problems for themselves and for their relationships.
And how angry that must they be deep down? There's that syndrome, isn't it? The angry doormat.
Yeah.
Where you're right, you're always relegating what you need behind the needs of others. But in the end, it creates a terrible kind of anger and depression. Perhaps. I once, yes. He shall remain nameless, not a very nice TV executive in the 80s, who at parties would introduce his wife saying, "This is the wife, don't laugh." And everybody would laugh in a kind of very uncomfortable way. And then 10 years later, I was on the set of a TV program and someone shouted out his name saying, "So-and-so's wife's just left him." And we all cheered. Because clearly she may have gone on a journey where she woke up. And I think that's what does happen to people, don't they? They get to an age where they think, "I've had enough," and they get some therapeutic help. And then you hear of, and you're right, women in particular, who now, you know, think, right, I have a platform now. And clearly we're living in a world where slowly but surely, you know, women's pay is becoming more equal, even though, you know, you can still have two newsreaders sitting next to each other at a major broadcaster and the female is being paid less than the man. So it's a kind of endemic thing, isn't it? Which...
Yes, I mean, it's part of the way society has developed. And I think that this echoism, I heard it first being presented about 6 or 7 years ago.
I've never heard of it. It's a brilliant
idea. No, it's a brilliant idea. And it was a psychoanalyst called Donna Savory who came up with it and has written a book about it. And it's now taken its place in the categories that psychoanalysts talk about.
And of course, isn't it ironic that it's taken a long time for someone to recognise it?
Yes, absolutely. Yes.
Because it's gone under the radar.
It has gone under the radar. It's the kind of thing that you perhaps just assumed was, you know, the kind of way in which couples, you know, tended to relate.
But getting back to narcissism, if we may, I mean, it's like, it just reminds me of that joke of, but enough about me, what do you think of me? You know, there are 9 signs of, this is good takeaway information for the podcast if you're listening, how to spot a narcissist. First of all, is number one is a sense of self-importance.
Right.
Second, preoccupation with power, beauty or success. 3, a sense of over-entitlement. 4, can only be around people who are important or are special. You know, the kind of people you're at a party and they're looking over your shoulder, seeing there's somebody slightly more important to talk to. 5, manipulative and exploitative. 6, arrogant. 7, a total lack of empathy. 8, must be admired. You could boil it down into 2 words, Donald Trump.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
What do we know about Ovid? Why would he write these kind of things?
Well, what do we know about him? He was a Roman poet. He was born at the height of the end of the Roman Republic in 43 BC, and he trained as a lawyer and then realised that it wasn't for him, and he became a poet.
Like a lot of lawyers.
Like, a lot of lawyers become poets. I'm not sure they do. But in his 20s, he starts seriously writing poetry, and right. he starts with a series, rather lovely series of letters called the Herodes, which are letters by the heroines of Greek myth, like Penelope.
Really? He wrote a kind of feminist?
Well, a bit
tract.
Like that. Yeah. Well, you know, this is what would have Penelope have written to Odysseus, or Ulysses, as he was known?
Well, where are you would have been a
yeah, where are you? What are you doing? Yeah. I hear you've captured Troy, yeah. and so on. So an amusing idea of turning things around. And then he went on eventually to write this massive work in 15 books of the Metamorphoses, the idea that everything transforms. It's as if, you know, nothing changes the same. So he gives us a series of myths in which individuals are transformed into beasts or birds and that sort of thing, or trees.
And they're full of these quests and trying to work out how the human mind and how the human spirit works.
There's a lot of psychology in all of this literature, but of course Ovid in some ways is even more open to what one might think of as a Freudian way of thinking than others. One of my favourite actually is Erisichthon, the Prince of Thessaly, who is sacrilegious, and he chops down a sacred tree, the tree of the goddess Ceres, and is cursed by the tree nymph, the Dryad, to eternal hunger. I thought about this when that tree was chopped down in Hadrian's Wall.
Oh,
last
yes,
year.
The sycamore.
Yeah. Yeah. And the curse that the tree nymph puts on the person who chops down the tree was that this person should never be satisfied. And so Erisichthon, after eating everything in his palace and in his grounds, ends up eating himself.
Wow.
So it's a great story of self-eating.
It's like a kind of Roald Dahl, isn't it? Sort of
it
short
is a bit,
story.
Yes, yeah. yes. Yeah. And Ovid tells it brilliantly, as he does all his other stories. There are a lot of myths that you could imagine could spawn psychological conditions. I mean, obviously there's the individual figures, such as Oedipus or Electra, which Jung then took up as the Electra complex.
Look, so let me just stop you there. So you obviously we know about Oedipus. Many people might not know about the Electra complex.
Yes, well, it was a slight afterthought, really. And the problem with the Oedipus complex is it seems to relate really to boys, infant males.
Yes.
Because they have a castration complex. You know, they fear the father.
Yeah.
They love the mother. Mm. The story of Oedipus, of course, brings us into all those complex issues of psychology. So the question is, what happens to young girls? Are they also feeling a sense of fear of their father, or is it fear of their mother? So Jung did talk about Electra. In the myth of Electra, she is the daughter of Agamemnon, who conspires with her brother Orestes to kill their mother, Clytemnestra. So the idea that somehow that the daughter has a similar hatred or fear of the mother as the boy has of the father is the idea of the
Electra. Do you think this is just Jung getting his own back on Freud?
In a way, you know, it's never really taken off.
I'll see your Oedipus and I'll raise you
an Electra.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't think he was particularly feminist.
But Freud won that one, didn't he? Because we all know about Oedipus. But
nobody hears about the Electra complex. And it's not as fully theorised in any way.
Maybe she was suffering from echoism.
Electra herself, no.
No. She was fiery.
Yeah, she was a fiery young woman. And one could perhaps have a look through Ovid's Metamorphoses and find all sorts of others and say, that sums up a psychological condition which human beings suffer from. I mean, Ovid was such a clever author. A later Roman author called Quintilian uses the phrase of him, nimium amator ingenii sui, which means too much a lover of his own genius. Someone who really loved himself the way he wrote so much that you could say he goes over the top. And there is actually a lovely story of someone who was discussing what would you dispense with out of Ovid's lines of verse. Mm. And Ovid was asked this question and he put his answer down. And also the question was asked, what's his favourite line of verse? And it was the same. So the line in Latin is one where there's a transformation of someone into a half man and half bull. And in Latin, that's a very nicely balanced phrase, semi virumque bovem, semi bovemque virum. Mm. A half man bull and a half bull man. And it they're so balanced and nice in the Latin that Ovid obviously thought it was his best line, but also his worst. But he, in the end, came a cropper. So
Ovid.
Right. Yes. So he, amongst other things, he wrote An Art of Love, Ars Amatoria, which was a book about how to seduce young women, where to go, where to find them, what to say to them, how to write to them, how to speak to them, and so on. And it's very tongue-in-cheek, obviously, but at some stage he seems to have come a cropper with the Emperor Augustus, and he talks about this. He was sent into exile, and he writes from exile, it was a carmen et error, which means a song and a mistake. So whether it was a song that there was a mistake, or whether they were two separate events.
And do we know what specifically offended
the Emperor? No, we don't. Unfortunately, we don't know what the song was or what the error was, but in 8 AD, around the age of 50, Ovid goes off into exile on the Black Sea, Pontus as it was then known. He goes to a city called Tomis, which is Constantia in today's Romania, and he writes from there Sorrows of Exile, which in Latin is Tristia, and Epistulae Exponto, Letters from Pontus. In which he deplores the fact that he is still in exile from his third wife, as it happens. He'd already divorced twice, and he misses his third wife back home.
Did we think that maybe he, in one of these poems, or Augustus, saw an implicit criticism of Augustus?
I think that there's an implicit political criticism of
because,
Augustus.
Because, you know, as I said, the ninth thing that narcissists have is they must be admired, and Augustus probably had a healthy dose of narcissism.
Very much so, yes.
So he obviously... Our poor Ovid offended a narcissist, which...
I'm sure that's exactly what happened, actually, that he was offended by Ovid poking fun at him in some way. And it could have been, you know, it could have been as remote as looking at the Metamorphoses, which says everything changes. But by book 15, what you have is Ovid extolling the Augustan regime. But actually, within the context of saying everything changes, the implication is even this isn't going to last.
Right.
So who knows whether that's the sort of, you know, underlying political critique that Augustus felt Ovid was levelling at him and felt it was subversive. It may have been that. It could have been something purely to do with his erotic verses.
So it's a kind of form of censorship, really. Let's face it, Augustus in the end was a dictator, and dictators don't like, I suppose, being criticised. And we see that in the modern world, don't we, where... I think last week, the Chinese government shut down an independent bookshop in Hong Kong because they thought the books were a bit dangerous on the bookshelves. This idea that free ideas and the exchange of ideas, it's dangerous, isn't it, to people who want to control the way we think?
It's particularly dangerous in an autocratic society in which, you know, one man like Augustus controls the power of, you know, over individuals. And I think, you know... It shows also the importance of literature in ancient Rome, of this kind of literature, that Augustus felt that Ovid was such a threat that he should send him into exile.
Yeah, no, in many ways it's severe, but nevertheless a kind of compliment. What conclusions do we draw from this then? What was Ovid trying to tell us? And then in the modern world, what's our view on narcissism?
So I think what Ovid tells us is that self-love taken to an extreme is destructive. I mean, that is the moral, you might say, of the story of Narcissus as he lays it out to us. This is someone who is a beautiful young man who has rejected lovers of both sexes and who ends up falling in love with himself, his image, and dying as a result. So that's pretty clear cut. You don't want to be an extreme narcissist.
And that is obsessive narcissistic personality disorder as we know it today.
Yes.
But, and you've articulated this very well in the podcast, it's a spectrum, isn't it?
It's a spectrum, and once the psychologists had got hold of the idea of narcissism, starting with the use of the word, as you say, by Havelock Ellis, and then going on to Freud, they found ways in which they needed to express the fact that human beings grow up requiring a certain degree of self-love, you know, a certain degree of self-respect, self-esteem, but not to the extent that it leads to their destruction or to the destruction of those around them.
Which goes back to the other great Greek kind of quality of moderation.
Nothing in excess, exactly.
Meiden agan.
Meiden agan, yes, nothing in excess.
And in fact, that is on Isn't that an inscription on the Delphi?
Inscribed on the Temple of Apollo at Delphi.
Right.
We'll talk about that another time.
I think we can leave it with that, really. Nothing in moderation.
Nothing in moderation. No. I think you got that one the wrong way around.
But I'm
nothing
afraid that's what we call a Freudian slip.
Very good.
And if you know my background, it definitely is a Freudian slip.
It's All Greek and Latin to Me is presented by Armand Dangour and Jimmy Melville. The producer is Diggory Waite, and the executive producer is Claire Broughton. It's All Greek and Latin to Me is a Hattrick podcast.
Hi, everyone. I just wanted to give a mention to Classics for All. Classics for All is a charity, and what we want to do is provide access to the classics to as many state school pupils as possible, alongside training teachers who don't actually have to have any previous training in the subject. They hope that they make classics a sustainable part of the school curriculum. If you want to find out more about this fantastic charity, go to the website. It's www.classicsforall.org.uk.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.